content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the November 25th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's tumultuous transition to power. What happened? President-elect Donald Trump's transition team was embroiled in turmoil this week, and his effort to fill cabinet and other key positions were slowed by infighting, firings, and confusion. Trump began the hiring process by naming Republican National Committee Chairman Rents Priebus as Chief of Staff and Steve Bannon, his campaign CEO, as the Executive Chairman of the alt-right website Breitbart News as Chief Strategist, an appointment that 169 outraged House Democrats demanded he rescind. Trump had earlier replaced Governor Chris Christie as head of his transition team with incoming Vice President Mike Pence, a power play thought to have been orchestrated by the president-elect's influential son-in-law, Jared Kushner, whose father Christie jailed during his time as a U.S. attorney. At least four other transition officials brought in by Christie were purged, including former House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers. Trump was focusing on a number of loyalists for his cabinet appointments. Rudy Giuliani was the leading contender to be Secretary of State, despite revelations that the former New York mayor did legal lobbying and consultancy work for Qatar, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and an Iranian exile group. Senator Jeff Sessions, a hardliner on immigration and a foreign policy hawk, was also under consideration for that role, as well as for Attorney General. The president-elect took to Twitter to attack the media for reporting that the transition was chaotic, insisting that the recruitment process was very organized, adding, "I am the only one who knows who the finalists are." After his election win, Trump held talks with President Obama at the White House, praising the outgoing commander-in-chief as a very good man whose counsel he would seek. He also spoke by phone with Russian President Vladimir Putin, with the two agreeing to work on repairing unsatisfactory Russian-American relations and forging a possible Syrian peace deal. In a TV interview, the president-elect said he wanted to preserve key parts of the Affordable Care Act and said that part of his proposed U.S.-Mexico border wall could be fencing. He also reiterated his pledge to appoint a pro-life justice to the Supreme Court. What the editorial said: Trump staked his campaign on the premise that his brilliant business acumen will make him a better president than any politician, said the New York Times. But as the manager of a vast federal government, he already seems in over his head. The president-elect needs to fill about 4,000 key government positions, with 1,270 requiring Senate confirmation hearings. Yet he has packed his transition team with family, friends, and hacks, not to mention the lobbyists and big donors he'd promised he'd get rid of, and seems content to let them fight one another for power and influence. Priebus was a sound choice because of his strong ties to congressional Republicans, said the Boston Globe. But Bannon doesn't belong within 10 miles of the White House. A profane bully once accused of assaulting his second wife, the former Goldman Sachs banker has turned Breitbart.com into a white nationalist swamp of racism, sexism, anti-Semitism, and Islamophobia. Bannon's association with unsavory white identity grievance politics does deserve a watchful eye, said the Wall Street Journal. But Bannon may simply serve to remind Trump that his election began as a rebellion against Washington. At the same time, the vague lines of responsibility between Priebus and Bannon are troubling. It will lead to a mess of leaking dysfunction if they divide into competing factions. Trump is setting up an administration mired in unprecedented conflicts of interest, said the Los Angeles Times. The president-elect has borrowed from a web of lenders, including the Bank of China and Russian investors, and his many real estate assets here and abroad will all be affected by the decisions he makes as president. Putting his children in charge of the business won't solve those problems. To avoid the appearance of impropriety, he needs to release his tax returns, reveal all foreign holdings and loans, and put the Trump Organization in a proper blind trust. What the columnist said, despite being a vocal never-Trumper, I urged national security officials to serve in the president-elect's administration for the good of the country, said former State Department counselor Elliot Cohen in the Washington Post. One talk with his team changed my mind. Trump is surrounding himself with mediocrites whose chief qualification seems to be unquestioning loyalty. And the scandals and mistakes that will ensue from the Trump administration will be exceptional. By setting the bar so low, the liberal media is setting Trump up to succeed, said Liz Peek in FoxNews.com. They're continuing to portray him as a vile, erratic, destructive loon. So when he and the Republican Congress push through major changes, the American people will be pleasantly surprised. Actually, Trump may find he has promised too much, said Jonah Goldberg in NationalReview.com. He once told his supporters he would make every dream you ever dreamed for your country come true. But as experienced politicians know, big policy decisions require lots of trade-offs and never please everyone. If Trump is going to be a successful president, and I hope he is one, he will have to start disappointing his biggest fans. And a second main story for you today. After election, protests and a spike in hate crimes. What happened? Tens of thousands of people across the U.S. continue to take part in daily protests, some of them violent, against the election of Donald Trump this week. In New York City, as many as 25,000 protesters converged on Trump Tower, bearing signs reading, "Not my president," and "Show the world what the popular vote looks like," referring to Hillary Clinton's lead of about 1 million votes. By the latest count, at least 350 people were arrested in Portland, Oregon, Oakland, and other cities as some demonstrations turned violent, with protesters smashing vehicles and throwing burning projectiles. President-elect Trump at first attacked the very unfair demonstrations, but backtracked amid criticism he was undermining the constitutional right to protest. "Love the fact that small groups of protesters last week have passion for our great country," Trump later tweeted. The divisive election also prompted a surge in racist and anti-Muslim incidents reportedly carried out by pro-Trump supporters. The Southern Poverty Law Center logged more than 300 hate crime complaints around the country following the election and said the spike was worse than after 9/11. Nazi and racist graffiti was scrawled on buildings in Philadelphia and other cities, and a Maryland church was vandalized with the words, "Trump Nation, Whites Only." In an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes, Trump said he was saddened to hear reports that his supporters were harassing minorities. "If it helps," Trump said, "I will say it right to the cameras. Stop it." What the editorial said. Blocked streets, spray-painted cars, broken windows, said the New Hampshire union leader. "This is what we were told to expect from angry Donald Trump supporters when Hillary Clinton won the White House. Yet here we are, watching the left having trouble accepting the results of a free and fair election that didn't go its way." "The hypocrisy is astounding," said the New York Post. as are the hysterical predictions that Trump's presidency will lead to Armageddon and a racist white lash against minorities. Reality check. Trump scored slightly less of the white vote than Mitt Romney, and higher proportions of blacks and Latinos. Half of the Portland protesters didn't even bother to vote, according to one survey. But Trump's victory has already had tangible and terrifying outcomes for minorities, said the Boston Globe. Muslim drivers have reportedly been accosted, and black students taunted by white Trump supporters. Did anybody think electing him would mean otherwise? Trump ran a 17-month campaign rooted in Islamophobia and racist rhetoric, and it's going quickly from words to actions. What the columnist said. While violence is obviously wrong, anti-Trump protesters have every right to take to the streets, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine. The U.S. has never voted for a man so openly contemptuous of democratic norms, who has threatened to jail opponents, enact mass deportations, and gleefully punish the press. Some liberals think protesters should give Trump a chance, said Stephen Thrasher in TheGuardian.com. But we must not let this misogynist, xenophobic bully become the new normal. Does the left even want peace? Asked Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. Many reports of racist incidents have already been debunked, unlike the real and confirmed violence of anti-Trump protesters. In Chicago, one man was dragged from his car and beaten while onlookers shouted, "He voted Trump." Trump isn't the left's main target, though, said Kevin Williamson in NationalReview.com. Look at the protesters again. America, America was never great. And you realize their real rage is directed at America itself. They think the U.S. is wicked, depraved, filled to the gills with hatred and bigotry, and all because their candidate lost. It's hard to see how the country unites at this point, said Charles Blow in the New York Times. The electoral map shows a handful of blueberries sprinkled on an endless spread of red sauce. Rural whites and urban populations now peer at one another to see people who don't look like them, racially, culturally, or politically. We are living in two diverging Americas at odds and at battle. Our controversy of the week, the Democrats. How do they rebuild? The Republican Civil War was supposed to start this week, said Jonathan Easley in TheHill.com. Instead, in the wake of Donald Trump and the GOP's stunning election win, a ferocious struggle has erupted on the left over the smoldering remains of the Democratic Party. To Bernie Sanders supporters, Hillary Clinton's defeat represents the clear, final failure of neoliberalism, in which the last two Democratic presidents prioritized globalization and pro-corporate policies over the economic security of working people. Much of the party establishment, meanwhile, is pointing to the narrowness of Clinton's defeat. She won the popular vote by more than a million votes, as proof that all the party needs is a new crop of younger, less compromised candidates with center-left appeal. The battle for the party's soul will begin with looming leadership contests, said Katie Riley in Fortune.com. Representative Keith Ellison, the first Muslim in Congress and far-left leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, is running to be chairman of the Democratic National Committee, against moderate former chairman Howard Dean, while Ohio Representative Tim Ryan is mounting a populist challenge to House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. The Democrats' existential crisis is just beginning. If the Democrats are going to change, said Ryan Cooper in TheWeek.com, it might as well be in the direction of social democracy. Clinton lost because Trump's angry populism won over a white working class whose welfare and protection was the Democratic Party's original reason for existence. In an age of still widening inequality, the Democrats' obvious move here is to stop promoting globalization and giving reassuring 225,000 speeches to Goldman Sachs, and return to their roots as the party that defends the poor against the rich. But Democrats should be wary of overcorrecting in a play for working class whites, said Connor Sinn in BloombergView.com. The U.S. population is only getting younger, browner, and more urban. Why should Democrats reinvent themselves when they can just hold on to the growing Democratic base? The belief that demographics would save the Democrats is the God that failed in this election, said Sean Trend in RealClearPolitics.com. Are white voters declining as a share of the electorate? Yes, but that percentage is still about 70%. And getting most of those votes will still win a party an awful lot of elections. The thrice-married womanizing Trump even won 81% of white evangelical votes. Because they are scared, they'll become powerless pariahs in a Democratic-dominated nation. If Democrats want a comeback, they'd better rethink their aggressive overreach on cultural issues such as contraception, baking cakes for gay weddings, and religious freedom. Democrats do need more white voters, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. But they have to give them a clear, coherent alternative to Donald Trump's populist nativism and Bernie Sanders' quasi-socialism. In this election, Democrats foolishly conveyed their satisfaction with the status quo. As they plot their revival, they need to come up with policies that assure working and middle-class Americans there will be good jobs for them in a globalized, technological world. Democrats also need to drop their obsession with identity politics, said William Salatin in Slate.com. We can continue to fight racism, sexism, homophobia, and Islamophobia. But as long as Democrats define themselves by their opposition to prejudice and dismiss the economic and cultural concerns of rural white America, they will keep losing elections. And on to our good week, bad week shorts. It was a good week for the mainstream media after the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal saw a 300 to 400% surge in subscription orders in the wake of Donald Trump's election. A lot of people feel compelled to respond in one civic way or another, said Richard Toefel of the investigative website ProPublica.org. And it was a good week for going out in style after developers in Texas announced plans for a $300 million luxury resort community for doomsday preppers with underground condos connected by tunnels. It's going to be a five-star resort with DEFCON 1 preparedness, a spokesman said. And it was a good week for product placement. After Ivanka Trump's jewelry company sent a style alert promoting the new first daughter's favorite bangle, a $10,800 diamond bracelet she wore during her father's post-election interview on 60 Minutes. But it was a bad week for leaving the dishes in the sink. After a French survey revealed that the number one cause of infidelity cited by married women was their husband's failure to do his fair share of the housework. It was a bad week for drawing parallels after a California high school teacher was suspended for a lesson in which he compared the rise of Donald Trump to that of Adolf Hitler. Everything I talk about is factually based, said Frank Navarro, a 40-year veteran teacher. If I'm wrong, show me where I'm wrong. And it was a bad week for foreign ticket sales. After Qatar's World Cup organizers announced that drinking will be banned during the 2022 soccer tournament, there will be no alcohol consumption on the streets, squares, and public places, said one official. And that is final. Our topic on the briefing page this week is legalizing marijuana. A majority of the U.S. population now has access to legalized cannabis in some form. What's the track record so far? Where is weed legal? Recreational use is now fully legal in 8 states plus Washington, D.C., after voters in California, Massachusetts, Nevada, and Maine approved marijuana ballot initiatives last week. On Election Day, voters in Arkansas, Florida, and North Dakota brought the tally of states with legal medical marijuana to 28. Though cannabis is still illegal under federal law, Election Day was widely considered a tipping point for the legalization movement. A recent Gallup poll found that 60% of Americans now approve of legalizing marijuana, and there is a growing bipartisan consensus that the $1 trillion war on drugs has failed. Criminalizing the use and sale of drugs has sent millions of nonviolent criminals to prison, a disproportionate number of them black, and empowered violent drug cartels. At the same time, there is growing scientific research showing that casual cannabis use by adults is fairly safe, less dangerous than alcohol or tobacco. Another major factor propelling legalization is that states can tax it and get a big boost in revenues. As one pro-legalization ad in Colorado put it, jobs for our people, money for our schools. Who could ask for more? What's happened in states that legalized weed? There have been some huge upsides as well as serious downsides. In Colorado, the booming new cannabis industry has created more than 18,000 full-time jobs and generated $2.4 billion in economic activity. The state tightly regulates weed sales. Adults over 21 can possess only 28 grams. And marijuana plants are tagged with a radio frequency ID chip so that they can be tracked. Products are tested for potency and contaminants and are sold in child-resistant containers. There are a certain number of folks, like myself, who are pretty reticent about legalization to begin with, said House Speaker Dickie Lee Hollingshorst, a Democrat. But the sky didn't fall. What are the downsides? Legal weed states have experienced a significant jump in marijuana-related DUIs. In Washington state, a record 745 drivers who were pulled over on suspicion of DUI in the first 6 months after a legalization tested positive for THC, the main mind-altering ingredient in marijuana, compared with 1,000 over the entire previous year. At the same time, the number of drivers involved in fatal car crashes who tested positive for THC rose by 48% between 2013 and 2014, when legalized marijuana hit the market. Hospitalizations for overdoses are also up. Washington serves as an eye-opening case study for what other states may experience with road safety after legalizing the drug, says Peter Kissinger, CEO of the American Automobile Association Foundation for Traffic Safety. Why are hospitalizations up? A big factor is edibles, said Dr. Michael DiStefano, who has seen at least 15 children admitted to the emergency room at Children's Hospital, Colorado, for accidentally ingesting cannabis. Edibles look like regular candy, DiStefano says. The number of overall patients hospitalized in Colorado who admitted to marijuana use spiked from 809 per 100,000 before legalization to 2,413 per 100,000 afterward. Is overall weed use up? Yes. As weed has become legal, easier to obtain, and cheaper, more Americans are smoking on a regular basis. About 10 million more Americans smoke marijuana now than 12 years ago, and the number who admit to using the drug on a daily or near-daily basis has more than doubled to 8.4 million people. About half of those heavy users reported symptoms of abuse and dependency, including getting stoned even when it negatively affected their relationships or jobs. You're seeing this headlong rush into another addictive industry without knowing what widespread marijuana use is going to do to society, said Jeffrey Zinnmeister, co-founder of the anti-legalization group Smart Approaches to Marijuana. And though teen use rates have so far stayed stable in legal weed states, there is concern that the drug's normalization will gradually encourage more adolescents to smoke. That's particularly worrying, given the scientific studies have connected adolescent marijuana use to a significant loss of IQ points and an increased risk of psychotic illness. Will it be legalized nationally? With Donald Trump's election, that's now completely up in the air. Weed is strictly prohibited under federal law and classified as a Schedule I drug, the same category as heroin. But the Obama administration has chosen not to enforce that law in legal weed states. Before November 9th, advocates were gearing up to lobby Congress and Hillary Clinton on federal legalization. But Trump is an unknown quantity. In previous years, the Republican president-elect has made comments in favor of medical marijuana. But Vice President Mike Pence and some potential cabinet picks are hardliners on drugs. Trump's election does not bode well for legalization, said Drug Policy Alliance's Ethan Nadelman. There are various ways in which a hostile White House could trip things up. Moving on to the best columns now, first two from the U.S. First one is titled, Obama's Costly Overreach. 8 years after he dazzled America with his political oratory, Barack Obama will lead the Democratic Party in shambles, said Jod Podhoretz. He was a political genius at getting himself elected, but for his party, he's been an unmitigated disaster. Since Obama took office in 2009, more than 1,110 Democratic federal and state elected officials have lost their jobs to Republicans. Democrats controlled 62 of the 99 legislative chambers in 2009. Now Republicans control 68. Democrats controlled 31 governorships in 2009 and now hold just 17. Obama's chosen presidential successor lost, and the man he condemned as unfit won. Why? Obama mistook his 2008 victory for an endorsement of a highly progressive agenda and forced through too much, too fast, too soon, including Obamacare, massive bailouts and stimulus spending, new taxes, and heavy business regulation. Obama also gave progressives an arrogant sense of cultural and moral superiority as they disdained traditional morality as an evil to be overcome and small-town Americans as bigots. New social fissures opened, creating resentments Republicans exploited. Democrats will weep when Obama leaves office, but the truth is that their hero presided over the collapse of the Democratic Party. Climate skeptics in charge. Of all the reasons to fear a Donald Trump presidency, said Will Oramus, perhaps the most important is the irrevocable damage he could wreak on the planet. Trump's stance on climate change got shamefully little attention during the campaign, but he's repeatedly said in the past that global warming is nonsense, a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese to hurt U.S. industry. Trump has also promised to defund federal environmental and clean energy programs and cancel U.S. participation in the Paris Agreement endorsed by 190 nations, the world's best hope to collectively slow greenhouse gas emissions. How much of this was political posturing? And how much does Trump really intend to do? No one knows, but it's extremely telling that he selected climate change skeptic Myron Ebel to head the transition at the Environmental Protection Agency. Ebel opposes environmental regulation and says there's too much alarmism over a little bit of warming. During his presidency, Trump will meet little resistance to an anti-environmental policy from a Republican Congress or a conservative Supreme Court, so the damage he could do could be incalculable. A half a century from now, future generations may still be paying the price for Trump's willful ignorance. This is a How They See Us column titled, Europe Loses Faith in an Old Ally. No more relying on NATO to keep Europe safe, said Nicholas Buss in Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung from Germany. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump said on the campaign trail that the Atlantic Alliance, the pact that has safeguarded the continent for nearly 70 years, is obsolete, and that the U.S. will only protect its European allies if they pay enough for the privilege. His comments couldn't have been made at a more dangerous time. Russia has doubled its military budget over the past decade and is increasingly aggressive on the international stage, sending troops into eastern Ukraine, gobbling up Crimea, and bullying the Baltic states. Even if Trump were to walk back his remarks, he has aroused doubts about America's commitment and loyalty. Will the U.S. defend a small, faraway country like Estonia from Russian aggression? If the answer to that question is not yes, but maybe, then deterrence is at an end. That's why Europeans must start contributing more to our own defense, said Stephen Glover in the Daily Mail. Each NATO member is supposed to spend at least 2% of its gross domestic product on defense, yet only 5 of the alliance's 28 nations meet that target. The U.S. is responsible for 70% of all military spending by NATO members. This is grossly inequitable. If Trump does slash the U.S. contribution to NATO, Europe must fill the gap, and that's where a post-Brexit UK can make itself indispensable. A Europe threatened by Russia and with America in retreat needs us more than it has for a long time. We shouldn't panic yet, said Vygaudas Ušakas in Vakaro Ekspresas from Lithuania. Trump is unpredictable and may not have meant what he said. During the campaign, he threatened to withdraw U.S. military support from South Korea, but 2 days after being elected, Trump promised that he'd be a steadfast and strong ally to Seoul and would protect the nation from North Korea. Anyway, whatever Trump decides, he is not a dictator. Lithuania still has friends in Congress, and many of them have a strong commitment to NATO. Our own president, Dalia Grybauskaitė, has said, no matter who is president in America, we always have confidence in America. Well, I don't, said Sylvie Kaufman in Le Monde. Unless Trump decides to entrust his foreign policy to a team of more conventional Republicans, his victory spells the end of the U.S. as champion of Western values. The current threat to the West is the rise of autocratic capitalism dominated by a strongman, as in Russia, China, and Turkey. Trump shows no antipathy toward that model. He favors protectionism over free markets and unilateralism over alliances. The oppressed will not be able to look to him for help, Instead, it will fall to German Chancellor Angela Merkel to take up the mantle of defender of the universal values of the free world. And we're on to our in-depth article, The Last Word, The Voters Who Swept Trump to Power. For millions of Americans, Donald Trump is a fearless outsider who will bravely take on a rotten political system, said journalist Mark Baraback and Nigel Dwara. His victory has brought them delight, relief, and genuine hope. When Audrey Katz and Ashley Wright finally decided whom to support for president, they kept the choice to themselves. They admired his business sense and blunt-spoken style, but voting for Donald Trump was not something the two were comfortable discussing before their election. Not with their friends, not with their boyfriends. Certainly not with their boss, a Democrat who supported Hillary Clinton. People were scared to say they were voting for him, Katz, 27, said as she stepped away from the bang of a cash register to the and the thrum of hair dryers at the upscale salon in Scottsdale, Arizona, where the two women work. Even now, when people hear she supported Trump, the 28-year-old Wright said, they think, oh, so you must be a racist, and that isn't fair or true. A week after the Republican businessman and reality TV star pulled off one of the most astonishing political upsets in the country's history, Americans are still trying to sort through the implications, trying to understand how it happened, trying to understand each other, trying to fathom the yawning gap between two Americas. To his many critics, Trump is a racist, a bigot, a misogynist, and a clown. The thought of him becoming the most powerful person on the planet is enough to produce stomach-churning anxiety, to bring sleepless nights and induce tears. But more than six dozen conversations with Trump voters across the country, Democrats, Republicans, political independents, turned up a thoroughly different perspective. They see an outsider unbeholden to a corrupt and rotten political system, and brave enough to stake bold positions. They consider him fearless enough to defy the confines of political correctness. They view him as a vastly successful businessman, but possessing a common touch, a working man's billionaire. His victory brought euphoria, relief. Edith Gatewood, 72, felt like twirling across the floor of her home in a Denver senior complex. Norman Gardner, 67, who runs a mobile home park in Shelbyville, Tennessee, wanted to go outside and holler at the moon. Joyce Riley, 65, who sells real estate in Florida's Panhandle, hadn't realized how bad she felt about the direction of the country until she saw the prospect of things getting better. "This is the first time I've been optimistic about the country in many years," she said. "I've been walking around singing, 'Happy days are here again.'" Sure, Trump has said some vile things during an exceedingly nasty campaign, sometimes acting in ways they wouldn't want their children to behave. But for those who supported him, that was part of what made him an unconventional candidate. He wasn't the typical stamped-from-the-mold politician. Trump was misunderstood and maligned by an arrogant and biased news media, his supporters say, and many of them feel misunderstood or maligned as well. Contrary to perceptions, it wasn't all angry white men, terrified of the country's changing hue, who swept Trump into office. Katz, the Arizona hairdresser, for instance, is dating a black man she expects to marry next April and looks forward to raising their mixed-race children. Wright lives in a multicultural community in the Phoenix suburbs and welcomes the Muslim and black children who scamper through her front yard. "I don't look outside and think my neighbors are going to bomb me," Wright said. though she welcomed the notion of a wall along the border with Mexico, an hour's drive from her parents' home in Tucson. The notion of two Americas, one ascendant and the other convinced it is slipping ever further behind, has become a staple of the country's politics and its national narrative as well. Many Trump supporters belong to the latter America, an America of dislocation and loss, lost jobs, lost opportunities, a lost sense of belonging, a sense of no longer mattering. In Shelbyville, a town of about 20,000 near the center of Tennessee, Gardner, the mobile home park operator, spoke of the businesses that have vanished. The company that built fireplaces, the factories that made pencils, the textile mills. Nothing's come in to take their place, he said. We need to bring industry back, and I think Trump can do it. Trump's economic nationalism resonated with Emmett Lawson, an African-American who fled Cleveland for Orlando after losing his job in a steel mill. He blames the North America Free Trade Agreement, which President Clinton signed into law and Trump derides as the worst bargain in the history of creation. Now, at age 58, Lawson drives a semi-truck hauling housing debris across Florida. It was bad, and Trump exploited it, Lawson said, of NAFTA. He saw it and spoke about it. That spoke to me. Trump is a business guy, Lawson said. That's the change that's needed. In Huntington Beach, California, Anthony Miskolin, 37, used to make six figures as a loan officer until the Great Recession hit. Now he toils in corporate sales, making $26,000 a year. He shares a house with four other people and commutes 3 hours by bus, having given up his car. He shoulders $57,000 in student loan debt. I never anticipated being in this situation, he said, soaking up the sun. One form of recreation he can still afford on an 80-degree day on the Orange County coast. My vote for Donald Trump, it wasn't out of bigotry. It wasn't out of hatred. It was about survival. Miskolin wants a better-paying job. He wants a stronger economy. He wants Trump to deal with illegal immigration, which Miskolin blames for soaring housing prices and sees as a drain on public services. I've been to the welfare office before, and a lot of people who go there don't speak English, Miskolin said. Most of the people who go there, they're not white. They're not even black. The most people you see there are mostly Mexican. They are illegal, and they don't belong in our country. Those racial undercurrents were an undeniable part of the Trump wave. For some, making America great again means returning to a time when it was whiter, more male-dominated, and more in line with what the religious right and its political allies consider traditional family values. Margot Miko, 62, a former nurse now living on disability in Ohio, was among those drawn by Trump's promises to build an impenetrable wall along the southern border and to keep out Muslim immigrants. She blamed her state's governor, Republican John Kasich, for allowing an influx of refugees that has made her feel like a stranger in her Columbus neighborhood. She cited an encounter on a hot summer day. She was out in shorts and a top when she ran into a woman in full Muslim garb. She looked me up and down and said, "You really should cover yourself," Miko recounted. I told her, "You need to take some clothes off. I bet you're really hot." She was quite nasty. Tanya Register, a 57-year-old Trump supporter in Fountain Valley in Southern California, said she has nothing against Mexicans. They were in the area long before she was, she noted, or the Asian immigrants filling up her Orange County neighborhood. It was plainly wrong, though, Register said, to see the White House lit up in rainbow colors to celebrate the Supreme Court's legalization of same-sex marriage. That was not cool to me, said Register, whose disability check helps care for an adult daughter and two grandchildren living with her. And I'm an American, too. To paint everyone who voted for Trump as a racist or a homophobe or woman hater, or to stuff every one of them into a basket labeled deplorable, to use Hillary Clinton's infelicitous term, ignores and delegitimizes a deeply held sense of abandonment, those voters contend. Everyone who voted for Trump is being called names, said Janet Flanagan, 54, as she stood outside a Thai restaurant and sushi bar in the courthouse square in Noonan, Georgia, a former cotton town about 40 miles southwest of Atlanta. We're called redneck, ignorant, racist, haters. The freelance writer went on, waving her hands in frustration. That's not true, she said. People voted for Trump because they felt they have not had representation in Washington for a long time. Change, of course, entails risk, and many readily concede there is considerable risk in handing the country over to a man who has never served in the military or spent a moment in government, something the country has never done in its entire history. But there's always risk, they said. And with 4 years of Hillary Clinton, they figured it was pretty clear what the country could expect. More economic inequality, more bloated government, more taxes, a continued loss of respect around the world. She has a proven track record, said Nancy Lewis, 58, who works for a medical answering service in Mendenhall, Mississippi. And it wasn't a very good one. Many liked what they saw on Wednesday morning after Election Day when Trump, apparently as surprised as most others, laid claim to the White House. He seemed more serious, they said, more responsible and sober, and they expect that to continue as the weight of the office settles on his shoulders. His mouth gets him in trouble, said Wayne Lee, 64, a truck driver from Palmetto, Georgia, who acknowledged it was somewhat nervous-making to think of Trump with his finger on the nuclear trigger. But I don't think his behavior is going to change. All these outbursts, they're not going to happen anymore. I think he's going to take it seriously. That, of course, won't be known for some time. It is clear what Trump supporters expect, in keeping with the grand, though often contradictory, promises he made during the campaign. A stronger economy that will produce more jobs with better pay, lower taxes, less bureaucracy, cheaper and more widely available health care. A reversal of the decades-long decline in the country's manufacturing industry and a revival of the struggling coal and steel industries. Better and safer airports, roads, and bridges. A muscular foreign policy that will deter aggression and make the country stand taller in the eyes of both friend and foe. A fail-safe policy that will keep people from entering the country illegally and, especially, keep terrorists offshore. I finally feel optimistic, said Miskellen, who earlier had watched the Veterans Day celebration in Huntington Beach. I think Donald Trump is not only going to be great for the country, but also great for the American people, not a small minority of bureaucrats and labor union members. To hear them tell it, Trump supporters want a government that no longer works to make the rich even richer, offers handouts to the undeserving, and caters to the whims of Washington's army of lobbyists and special interests. Perhaps more than anything, they want a president who pays attention to the half of the country bereft of hope. That, they said, would truly make America great again. This was originally published in the Los Angeles Times. We're on the health and science page now. Did Earhart die a castaway? It's widely assumed that Amelia Earhart's 1937 attempt to become the first female pilot to circumnavigate the globe ended when her twin-engine Lockheed Electra crashed in the Pacific Ocean. But new research has added weight to the theory that the celebrated aviator may in fact have managed to land on a remote, uninhabited island and survived for weeks or even months as a castaway. The speculation is based on skeletal remains that were found on Niku Maroro, or Gardner Island, in Kiribati in the South Pacific, 3 years after Earhart's ill-fated trip. The possibility that the bones were Earhart's was initially rejected after a doctor who examined them concluded they belonged to a short, stocky man. But in 1998, forensic anthropologists working with the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, TIGHAR, re-examined the doctor's files and concluded that the remains actually belonged to a woman of Earhart's height and ethnicity. Now, after further analysis of the original measurements and photographs, the bones themselves were lost decades ago. Those researchers have determined that the skeleton's larger-than-average forearms were almost exactly the same size as Earhart's. The match does not, of course, prove that the castaway was Earhart, TIGHAR's Richard Gillespie tells CESmonitor.com, but it is a significant new data point that tips the scales further in that direction. The TIGHAR team is planning an expedition to Niku Maroro for next year to search for the Lockheed Electra in the deep water off the island. The health scare of the week, hypochondria and heart disease. Worrying about getting sick may actually make you sick. That's the conclusion of a new study from Norway that suggests hypochondriacs are at greater risk for heart disease, reports The Guardian. Researchers asked 7,052 adults to complete questionnaires about their health concerns and then undergo physical exams. About 10% of the volunteers had health anxiety. They essentially worried about ailments they didn't have. When the researchers tracked the volunteers' heart health for 12 years, they found that those with health anxiety were 71% likelier to develop cardiac problems. The more severe their anxiety, the higher their risk. These findings don't prove that hypochondriac causes heart disease, but the study's authors nevertheless believe that taking steps to ease unnecessary anxiety could have health benefits. Instead of worrying about what's going on with your body and running to the doctor for any physical health problem, says lead author Linnea Edenberg, people should seek a proper diagnosis and help for the anxiety disorder. On the Talking Points page, Electoral College, it's 2000 all over again. Largely lost amid the general astonishment over Donald Trump's election victory is one rather pertinent fact, said Andrew Trees in USA Today. The president-elect won fewer votes than his opponent. While Trump secured all important 270 Electoral College votes, he currently trails Hillary Clinton by more than 1 million votes overall, or 0.8%. And with millions of ballots still to be counted on the deep blue West Coast, that gap is expected to widen to about 2 million votes. In 2000, Al Gore got only 560,000 more votes than George W. Bush. For the second time in 16 years and the fourth time in U.S. history, our system has foiled the popular will. The Electoral College has to go, said the Baltimore Sun in an editorial. The absurdly convoluted system, under which each state is allocated one vote for every representative and senator it has in Congress, fundamentally violates the principle that each American voter should have an equal say in deciding who is president. Abolishing the Electoral College is a lousy idea, said John Steele Gordon in CommentaryMagazine.com. Under the current system, recounts are necessary only in one or two states. With a popular national vote, close elections would require a recount of every ballot in the country. Imagine the chaos of Florida in 2000, but on a national scale. The Electoral College also incentivizes candidates to pay attention to small states they'd otherwise ignore, like New Hampshire. That's an absurd argument, said Scott Lemieux in NewRepublic.com. The current anti-democratic system forces campaigns to focus on a handful of swing states at the expense of everywhere else. It also gives disproportionate power to sparsely populated rural states and effectively disenfranchises minorities concentrated in big cities. Those hoping for reform shouldn't hold their breath, said Julian Zalazar in WashingtonPost.com. Smaller states would block a constitutional amendment to get rid of the Electoral College, as well as any other effort to render it moot. It's pointless talking about who won the popular vote, said Josh Gellertner in NationalReview.com. Millions of Americans in deep red or blue states probably didn't bother voting because their state's electoral votes always go to either Republicans or Democrats. If everyone knew their input was crucial, who knows how it would affect the popular vote? As long as there's an electoral college, there is no true popular vote. And a couple of short notes as we finish out. About 100 million eligible voters elected not to cast a ballot in this year's presidential election, according to the turnout estimates from the U.S. Elections Project. About 132 million did vote, by percentage, the lowest turnout since 1996. Slovenian native Melania Trump will be the second foreign-born first lady in U.S. history. The first was English-born Louisa Adams, wife of John Quincy Adams, who served as first lady from 1825 to 1829. And we'll finish with a quote from singer and poet Leonard Cohen, who passed this week. He says, "Reality is one of the possibilities I cannot afford to ignore." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.